what we're going to discuss this evening is something that is actually being discussed today, tomorrow, all the way until Monday, a very, very contentious and heated debate and major discussion that I think is very important and very interesting at the same time. It has a lot of halachic ramifications, a lot of personal ramifications for different people. And the story goes as follows. There is a famous or infamous ma'agen who has been ma'agen his wife for, I think it's already been 20 years or somewhere close to that. And this is a story that's been going on out of the West Coast. I'm not going to give too many details because I don't want to be arrested. And this is something that has been in and out of Batei Dinim and something that has just dragged on and on. And I'm sure that, as in every relationship, each side is responsible for some kind of problem along the way. I'm sure the husband is partially responsible. I'm sure his wife is partially responsible for the marriage dissolving. Whatever it is, for 20 years, there is no excuse for a woman not to have a get. Whatever happened, whoever's fault it was, there is no excuse at all at this point for a get not to be given. Everything has been tried along the way. This husband actually went ahead and got remarried along the way. So his wife is really stuck. Usually that's something that holds a husband back and really tries to push him to give a get when he knows that he's unable to get married along the way without doing so. We'll talk about that as well. Anyway, as things are, there was a point in time when this husband's mother was very sick, and she was supposed to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, and she passed away, and somebody called me with a great idea, asking, can you ask Rav Schechter whether or not we have a right to hold up the kvura in Eretz Yisrael, that they shouldn't bury his mother until he gives his wife a get. I thought that was a very ingenious plan, a very great idea. My father thought 100% they should go ahead with such a thing, and that should be something that obviously would probably compel him to give the get. What ended up happening was, since we don't have jurisdiction over what goes on in Israel, we contacted the chief rabbi's office. Rabbi Lau was very excited about this idea. Not excited, it was an unfortunate story, but he was very enthralled by the idea. He thought it made sense. And he said he's going to lead the negotiation. He's going to make sure everything's taken care of. In the end, he obviously didn't realize who he was dealing with, and they pulled a very fast one over him. He held up the kvura for 4 or 5 hours in the airport. He wouldn't let the Chevra Kadisha take the body. Then he said, okay, I worked out a deal. Everything's fine. And in the end, obviously the deal was not a deal, and they buried the body, and the son was on his way back to Israel. Now, the other parent is now sick again, I don't know what's going to be. It doesn't look like he's going to be getting any better, and now the discussion has reappeared again. Should we make not just a law for this person, but should there be law in Israel right now that if you have a ma'agen whose parents are being supportive of his efforts not to give his wife a get, should we withhold that body from being buried? That is the question. The reason why it's omed al haperek right now is because this went to the Supreme Court in Israel. They said that this is a religious matter and it has to be decided by Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, who is the Sephardi chief rabbi, and that decision is coming down on Monday, this coming Monday. So today I was on the phone back and forth with many organizations in Israel, many rabbanim, back and forth. Rav Asher Weiss weighed in about it, and many, many have said whatever they think should be the right outcome of this, and I think it's a very important topic. I think it's a very interesting issue, and I think it's good for us to be aware of what's going on in the world. We may not be aware of what's happening beneath the surface, but this is actually something that is being heavily debated and discussed over the next couple of days. So why not? Let's get involved. First of all, the original term aguna is something that is a little bit of a misnomer. When the Gemara talks about an aguna, it's talking about a case where you have a couple that's happily married, everything's fine, and the husband goes away on a business trip, or he goes away to visit a relative, or whatever it is, he goes out to war, and we do not know his whereabouts. We don't know what happened to him, and now we're in a situation where this woman is stuck because she doesn't know how to move on with her life. Her husband is nowhere to be found. Nobody has told us that he has died, and therefore she's unable to get married and she's unable to live with him. Either way, and therefore we assume she is referred to as an aguna. That is the original definition of an aguna that is described in the Gemara. Then, in more modern times, this became expanded. This term became more of an enlarged term, and basically it refers to any unfortunate situation where you have a spouse who was unable to move on without a get being given, that is now referred to as a case of igun. So for example, if you have somebody who is in a coma, you have a husband who is in a coma, and he is unable to give his wife a get because he's simply not able to give instructions to do so, or you have a woman who's in a coma, and therefore her husband is stuck. The same works in the other direction. And let us make it very clear. There are organizations that advocate for the resolution of aguna situations, and sometimes they'll advocate for a husband, and sometimes they'll advocate for a wife. It's not always the husband's fault. It's not always he's the one that's holding up the divorce. Sometimes it's the woman who's refusing to accept the get, and it's the woman who's refusing to come to the table. So that's why you have to look into it very carefully. Don't ever take a side without sitting down with both, without really investing your time and understanding what's going on. And that is very important. If you're not prepared to do that, just don't get involved at all and don't have an opinion, which is fine too. But if you're going to have an opinion and you want to get involved, you have to really sit down and understand what's going on. So if you have a situation where the husband is incapacitated or the wife is debilitated and impaired and unable to actually accept a get, in a situation like that, we refer to that as an unfortunate case of igun, where either he's unable to move on or she's unable to move on. Or more conventionally, what we're used to is when you have somebody who is choosing to be stubborn, who's choosing to be inflexible, and is choosing not to give a get. In a situation like that, we refer to that as an aguna. A common refrain that we've all heard many, many times is, why can't the Rabbanim just figure it out? Why can't the poskim figure it out? Come on, we figured everything else out in the world. There's no way to figure out how to circumvent, how to overrule this issue of igun. You can't figure out how to get a woman divorced. Very good question. I actually saw a story in Rav Moshe Shtermach's Tshuva where he writes that the Kavna Rav was trying in his generation, this was before the war, he was trying to deal with a group of, I think it was Reform, I don't know if it was Reform or Conservative, but whoever it was, it doesn't really matter, where in his generation they said, you know, we have this age-old mitzvah of chalitza, and it's so uncomfortable. I don't know, anybody here ever been to a chalitza? I've been to a few chalitzas. It's very strange. You have to spit in front of each other. It's a very strange kind of mitzvah, but that's what the Torah says we're supposed to do. So the reformer, the conservative of his generation came and they approached him and they said, you know, we just got to get rid of this mitzvah. It makes no sense. It just doesn't fit with the conventional norms. You would never spit in front of another person, and then certainly you wouldn't say that you're doing a mitzvah by doing so. That doesn't make sense. Got to get rid of the mitzvah of chalitza. So that's what they came, and they said, the Rabbanim have to be mevatel the mitzvah of chalitza. The Kavna Rav said to them, you know, I think that the doctors have to get rid of this idea of death. So they turned to him and said, well, a doctor can't really get rid of death. That's something that God decides. And he said, well, a rabbi can't get rid of a mitzvah either. That's something that God decides. And I felt that that was a very interesting story and a very nice way to put it. And it's true. We have rules and regulations. We have a whole system of how the Torah works. We have a Torah of mitzvahs that was given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If the Ribbono Shel Olam said these are the rules of how a get is supposed to be given and this is the administration that's necessary for something to go from one to the other, then that is something that we need to follow. And the rabbi can't just get rid of it, just like the doctor can't get rid of the concept of death, as painful as it is, and as much as it has to hurt all of us that somebody is stuck and unable to move on with life, we have to understand that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes wants, and this is sometimes the situation where we find ourselves. When you have a woman who is not able to get herself a get for whatever reason, in a situation like that, she is unable to go and marry anyone else. In fact, not only is she unable to marry someone else, she's unable to have any intimate relationship with another person. And if she does, that's considered a sota. She's considered a woman who has betrayed her husband, even though she's no longer living together with him. But so long as she doesn't have a get from that husband, she's not able to be in a relationship with anyone else. And if she is and has a child, that child will be a mamzer, which is why forgetting about the terrible pain that's caused to her by unable to move on, if she then goes ahead and has a relationship with someone else and has a child, which is not so unlikely, what do you expect a woman to do? In a situation like that, she'll then create a mamzer, which causes much larger problems, much bigger issues. Aside from that, when you have a husband who has not yet given his wife a get, he still has a chiyuv mizonos. He still has a chiyuv to feed and support and take care of his wife. Because until he gives the get, he has signed a ksuba that says he is going to take care of her. Actually, there was a major stir in Israel last week. I don't know if anybody heard about it. There was a dayan in Bnei Brak who noticed that on the ksubas over the last 10 years, there was a standardized ksuba that everybody was using at all the weddings they were going to. All the Masada Kedushin go to the store, they buy a ksuba, and then the Masada Kedushin, you don't write up your own nusach ksuba. And he just noticed last week that over the last 10 years, the ksubas that have been sold in the store that are just the standardized text are missing the word azon. When a husband promises that he's going to feed and take care of his family, that word was for some reason not in there. And he quoted that the Nachla Shiva, which is a very authoritative sefer on Hilchos Gittin, writes that if a husband does not take upon himself that he's going to support his family, that's not a marriage. What does that mean? How can you take upon yourself that you're going to get married and you're just not going to take any responsibility along with that? So he said, what do we do? Over the last 10 years, everybody got married. Everybody had this word missing in the ksuba. And now it turns out that maybe they weren't married in the first place. I happened to show the article to my father. He thought the whole thing was a joke. He really thought I was showing him a Purim joke. He said, it's ridiculous to even make such an issue out of it. He said, it's clear we have such a halacha, it's called yados, which means if something is implied, it's implicit, and it's obvious that that's what you meant, even though it's not in the shtar, even though it doesn't say it explicitly there, but it's obvious that this is what you meant to take upon yourself, that it's included in a shtar, it's included in an arrangement that we have with each other. And my father thought, it's clear, every husband knows, or every husband needs to know, that he has an obligation to support his family. If it's not in the ksuba, he took upon himself anyway. The Masada Kedushin spoke to him at the wedding and said, these are your obligations, A, B, C, and D. If it's not in there, it means he has an obligation to do so regardless. Anyway, that's just a side point, interesting issue. But that certainly is something that a husband will have to do. We can talk about that after, but it's an interesting story. Anyway, when the marriage dissolves, it's in everyone's best of interest that they actually get divorced. It's in the husband's best of interest. Why? Because then he will no longer have to pay mizonos. He will no longer have to support her. It's in the wife's best of interest so that she can go ahead and get remarried, and that he can go ahead and get remarried. So it's in everyone's best of interest to get divorced. Now, along the way, everybody has all kinds of reasons why they don't want to give a get, why they want to hold it up, and sometimes the process gets delayed a little bit till they finish negotiating the terms of the divorce. All kinds of reasons, okay, but there's a reasonable amount of time that all of us would assume somebody should wait for a get. To say that somebody has to wait 20 years for a get sounds completely unreasonable by all measures and by all standards, and that's the case that we're talking about here. Now, let's just lay down a couple of facts that you need to know when we talk about such a case. Number one, the Torah says that when a couple gets divorced, the husband has to be the one who actively divorces his wife. It cannot go the other way. The woman cannot give a divorce to her husband, even though she's sick of him, even though she doesn't want to be married to him. He is the one who has to give a divorce to her. He has to write the get, and he has to give it to her. If he doesn't know how to write a get, which most husbands do not know, so he hires a sofer, he has to pay for the sofer to write it on his behalf. The sofer serves as his shaliach, and then the get is then going to be given to the woman. But it all has to be done miritzono. The Gemara says it has to be done on his own accord, on his own volition. He has to decide that he wants to do this, and after doing so, he then can divorce his wife. What if you have somebody who is forced to do so? What if somebody is involuntarily giving a get? The Gemara says such a get would be invalid. That is referred to as a get meuse. And this is why it becomes very complicated. Because on the one hand, we need the husband to explicitly state that he wants to divorce his wife. On the other hand, if we put pressure on him, then maybe it gets to a level where it's now not miritzono anymore. Maybe it's not something that he wanted to do, which would potentially invalidate the get entirely. So this is the very touchy ground that we have to think about whenever we have these kinds of issues. And people are so quick to say, let's go make a rally, let's go this, let's go that, let's just start screaming and yelling. It's not always so simple. It's not always so pushy, because these are the two factors that you have to keep in mind. Number one, we need the husband to actually say on his own that this is what he wants to do. On the other hand, it can't be something that was forced by an external factor that may have gotten him to do so. So that's what we're going to talk about, and it's a very important issue. However, the Shulchan Aruch does say that if you have certain situations that come up, if you have a certain situation that comes up in the marriage, for example, husband says, you know what, we just can't be intimate anymore, for whatever reason, it's just something that we can't do anymore. And the wife says, what do you mean? But this is not a marriage. What kind of marriage is that? Or other situations like that, someone is infertile. A wife said, a husband or a wife. The wife said, what do you mean? I got married and my assumption was I was going to be able to have children. Now it turns out you're unable to have children. He says, yeah, but I love you. She says, I love you too, but I want to have children. So what are you supposed to do? So that's a decision that a wife has a right to make, where she can say, I want out of this marriage. And in such a case, the Shulchan Aruch says, a bezdin, a reputable bezdin, has a right to strong arm the husband and force him, even if he's screaming and yelling that he doesn't want to. But if there's a reason why this marriage is absolutely impossible for it to move forward, in a situation like that, the Shulchan Aruch says, we have a right to force him, even though he does not want, that would not be referred to as a get me'usa. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says, and that is very clear in the Gemara as well. Now, my father is of the opinion that basically most of the situations that we have today of aguna fall under that category. For whatever reason, you have an abusive spouse. So that's the same. The Gemara is basically giving examples of a marriage that's impossible for it to last. So if you have an abusive spouse, that may also be a case where you just cannot have the marriage last. Or many other of the examples that we have today, emotional abuse or other things like that, where the couple gets to a point where they can't even be in the same house together anymore. They're separated for 20 years. Is that not the same as what the Gemara says? So my father's of the opinion that really, Me'ikar Adin, we have a right to force every get on a husband today, basically. Why? Because the Gemara is just giving two or three examples where we find that a marriage is impossible for it to last. And in that case, the Gemara says you have a right to force the husband to divorce his wife. So today, what's the situation? When we come and we're confronted with the case of Aguna, usually it's at a point where it's impossible for the two parties to be together, for whatever reason, whoever's fault it is. But that's where the case is now, once it comes to us. In that case, my father really is of the opinion that we would assume such a person is allowed to be forced to give the get. That is not what we generally assume. That is not what we generally do. We don't rely upon that. But I think my father's argument is a very strong one. If you look at the cases that the Gemara gives here and that are outlined here in Shulchan Aruch, you'll see that it's not so far off from the situations that we are presented with today in our generation. So what if you have a situation that does not fit that short halachic list that the Shulchan Aruch gives? The husband is fertile, they were able to have children, and everything else is fine, but they want to get divorced, and now the husband doesn't want to give a get. So is there anything that we can do to take care of this marriage? Is there anything we can do to dissolve the marriage in a way, even though when the husband may not want to? So, there are two critical pieces of information that we need to introduce here. Number one, the Gemara says, Nosei Adam Kama Nashim Al Ishto. As far as the Gemara is concerned, a man is allowed to have as many wives as he wants. A woman is unable to marry two husbands, but a man is unable to marry more than one wife, so long as, the Gemara says, he is able to afford all of them. It's a very interesting provision that the Gemara gives, and it's something that the Gemara says is absolute. If he's not going to be able to sustain the spending habits of all of his many, many multiple wives, then he's not allowed to marry them, because that is a responsibility that every husband takes upon himself. So that's number one. The Gemara says that he's allowed to marry as many wives as he wants. Rabbeinu Gershom, in the 10th century, lived in France, one of the great Gedolei HaRishonim. Rabbeinu Gershom, for a variety of reasons, said, no, we have to change this. This doesn't make sense. We're going to have a husband go and marry five different women. The Rishonim argue why he said this can't be. Number one, maybe they say, because how do you think the women are going to feel toward each other? Oh, he likes you better, he likes me better, they're going to be fighting with each other. It doesn't make sense. Number two, they say, what if he has children from both wives? Then the children are going to end up potentially marrying each other. You're not allowed to marry a brother and a sister, and maybe they're not going to be living in the same house. Maybe this child is going to be living in a house in a different city, and this child is not even going to know their brother or sister, and then they're going to end up marrying each other. It doesn't make any sense. Rabbeinu Gershom, for a variety of reasons, said, this does not make sense. And therefore, Rabbeinu Gershom said, from here on in, nobody's allowed to marry more than one wife. You can only have one wife at a time. If you divorce or the wife passes away, then he can think about going and getting married to someone else. But until that happens, he has no right to marry another woman, even though the Gemara clearly states that it's mutter. Rabbeinu Gershom changed that. That's number one. Number two, at the same time, Rabbeinu Gershom also made another takana, another gzera, which was, he instituted that it's not permissible for a man to divorce his wife against her wishes. Rabbeinu Gershom said, what does it mean? One day, a guy's going to be upset. He's going to walk into the house and give his wife a get, and she's going to be screaming and yelling, what do you mean? We had a perfect marriage. Everything was great. He says, yeah, okay, I found someone else in the office today. What does that mean? Just going to leave her hanging high and dry just for no good reason? Bal Karcha? Says Rabbeinu Gershom, we have to change this. A husband is only allowed to divorce his wife once they're in a divorce proceeding, once they're discussing it. You can't just walk in one day out of nowhere and force the woman to accept a get. That would be something that is unconscionable. About 200 years later, the Rashba is presented with a question where he wants to know, well, you know, we have this idea of Rabbeinu Gershom's two halachas. Number one, that you're not allowed to marry additional wives. Number two, that a husband is not allowed to divorce his wife against her wishes. So he says, so what happens? Did everyone accept that? Was that something that was universally accepted? So he says, no, in France and Germany, they accepted this takana. But in our communities, this did not latch on. This was not something that became widespread practice. This was something that Rabbeinu Gershom saw people in his neighborhood were prutzim. The men in his neighborhood were out of control. They were marrying women all over the place. They were doing terrible things, treating their wives improperly. So he had to make a takana. But that has nothing to do with our community. That was something that was limited to France and Germany and the surrounding areas. But our communities in Barcelona and Spain and other places, we never heard of this. We don't accept it. And this is not something that we worry about at all. The Rashba says in his community, there were many great upstanding people who had multiple wives and it worked out very nicely and everything was fine and nobody had a problem, nobody objected. So clearly you see, writes the Rashba, that we do not accept this Rabbeinu Gershom, and maybe in his community they followed him, but outside of that, nobody did. Okay, that's what he writes. On top of that, other Rishonim say that even if Rabbeinu Gershom's takana was accepted, it was only for his generation, it was only meant to be a temporary gzera, until we take care of the problem, until husbands learn how to treat their wives. But beyond that, we don't have to worry about it, and therefore it basically became obsolete on its own. It became irrelevant on its own, because after a certain one or two generations, we no longer follow this at all. That is what the Rishonim say. Now, this is the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins as well. The Shulchan Aruch says, I don't know anything about this Rabbeinu Gershom, we never accepted it, the Sfardim don't accept it at all, and the Ramah is very quick to point out, hey, slow down here, it's not true. He says, it is unacceptable for a husband to have two wives, this is something that is not going to work out well, and we absolutely have accepted this Rabbeinu Gershom. A husband is not allowed to divorce his wife against her wishes, and number two, he is not allowed to marry more than one wife at the same time. That is what the Ramah paskins for all Ashkenazim. And as mentioned, this is a machlokas between Sfardim and Ashkenazim. The Sfardim assume that one would be technically allowed to marry many wives at the same time, and the Ashkenazim follow the Rama, which is why Rabbi Avadia writes in one of his tshuvas that he was upset that the Batei Dinim in Eretz Yisrael were forcing Sfardim to divorce when they heard that somebody had two husbands, they were forcing him to divorce one of them. I'm sorry, two wives, thank you. Nowadays, you don't know. So, when a husband had two wives, so they were forcing him to divorce one of them. Why? It's because we have the Chayim to Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbi Avadia said, yeah, but we're Sfardim. What do you mean? In our communities, in Egypt and in Morocco and all these places, they never had an issue with it at all. And therefore, Rabbi Avadia says, he didn't think it was proper that the Ashkenazi Batei Dinim and Eretz Yisrael were forcing the Sfardim to follow the Rabbeinu Gershom's takana here. Okay, be it as it may. Even for an Ashkenazi who follows the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, the Shulchan Aruch brings down an important case. Writes the Shulchan Aruch, Misha nodalo she'ishto nichvis. Let's say there's a couple that has a wonderful marriage, everything's going fine, but then the woman comes down with some kind of terrible condition, a terrible sickness, epilepsy, and she just can't function. It's not a functioning marriage. Now, you can argue that's when the husband is needed even more to support his wife, to get her through it, and to make sure that she's getting the proper care that she needs. Okay, that's a good husband supposed to do that. And you can't blame people who make decisions in either direction. I shouldn't have said a good husband. There are good husbands who do, good husbands who don't. I don't know. I don't know what the right thing to do is. But that's the situation that the Shulchan Aruch gives. Somebody whose wife becomes unable to function. She's nichvis, it says. She's epileptic. Virotza legarsha. He says, you know, I can't take this anymore. I'm unable to take care of her. I don't know what's going to be. We don't have a regular marriage anymore because she's unable to function in the normal capacity that she used to. She can't take care of the kids. I need a functioning house. I don't know what to do. So in a situation like that, writes the Shulchan Aruch, he wants to divorce her, but he doesn't have enough money to pay the ksuba. He didn't see this coming in a million years. So he didn't set aside money for it. So what's he supposed to do? Says the Shulchan Aruch, we force her to accept the get. Even though he doesn't have enough money, the Shulchan Aruch writes, he'll give her whatever money he has, and over time, he obligates himself that when he has extra money, he's going to have to pay it out. But we force her to accept the get in such an unusual case like that. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Okay, writes the Ramah, this only applies, when can we force a wife to accept the get? Only when it's a mum gadol kazeh, when you have something so out of the ordinary like this, the woman's simply unable to function in a situation like that, that's when we'll force her to accept the get. But stam, a husband wakes up, he says, I don't like the way she does this, I don't like the way she does that. We're not going to force her to accept a get. Figure it out. You know, you're married to each other, figure it out. This is not something we're going to force one or the other. This is something that we assume either you figure out or you talk to each other and you decide that this marriage has now dissolved and you're not going to go ahead with it and you're going to get divorced. Now, here's the problem. The husband, as we mentioned, can't be forced to give a get. The wife, as we mentioned, can't be forced to accept a get either. That's Rabbeinu Gershom. Neither of them are able to remarry because, right, as long as you don't have a get and he's not giving it or she's not accepting it, neither of them can remarry. So what do you do? It's a catastrophe in both directions. Whoever's holding back is causing for a major problem, is really making the other person stuck. So there is a slight, very unusual and rare workaround, and that is what's referred to as a heter me'er rabbanim. What's a heter me'er rabbanim? It is very, very much misunderstood. A heter me'er rabbanim means if you have 100 rabbanim, as the Rishonim say, you went to 3 different communities in 3 different places where people don't even know each other, and you explain to each of the 100 rabbanim in 3 different continents, 3 different communities, you explain to them exactly what happened and why it is that you feel you have a right to divorce your wife and she's simply not accepting, and 100 rabbis agreed with you that your story makes sense, and they sign off on a piece of paper to to agree to such a thing, then, says the Gemara, you're able to get remarried without giving your wife a get. That's the story that the Rishonim say. Now, how often are you going to actually get 100 Rabbanim to buy your story in 3 different continents? It's not so easy. It's not so simple. And that is why a Heter Mei Rabbanim is very unusual. We have fake Batei Dinim here in America that somehow produce these, you know, for the right fee. They're willing to do anything, which is what one of these men actually did. He got a Heter Mei Rabbanim, which nobody ever saw, which nobody ever heard of, which no rabbi that we know ever signed. And yet he said, all right, so 100 rabbis signed on a document that I'm allowed to remarry, and that's what he did. He went off on his own, he got remarried. I don't know who the Masada Kedushin was. And he's now living his life, and his wife is still stuck. So that is a very, very unusual kind of thing. So sometimes that's very rare that we're going to actually have such a situation where there is a very prominent story. You may not be aware, but there's a very, very, very prominent Rosh Hashiva in America who was living in Eretz Yisrael. And whatever it was, for family reasons, he had to come back to America, and it made sense. But his wife refused to accept the get, for whatever reason. She was from a very prominent family in Eretz Yisrael. She refused to accept the get, but he needed to move back for his job, and she refused to move to America. So she was of the opinion that he's ruining the marriage. This was way before I was born, so I don't know the exact details of the story, but it's a very famous story. He got a Heter Mei Rabbanim legitimately. His wife refused to accept the get. He had to move back to America to take a certain job, whatever it was. And what are you going to do? A stalemate. So in a case like that, they had a Heter Mei Rabbanim that was drawn up, but that was a legitimate Heter Mei Rabbanim that was drawn up by a lot of the Gedolim of this generation, felt that that was good grounds to allow him to go and get remarried without giving his wife a get. And he put the get in escrow, that if at some point she's prepared to accept it, here it is. He's not hiding anything, he's not holding her up, he's prepared for her to go on and move on with her life. As far as I understand, she never got remarried, and that was, I don't know, must have been 35, 40 years ago, at least. So Nebuch, you have a situation like that, but that's her own. She decided not to accept the get. That's her own problem. But in a situation like that, again, that's very, very unusual. That's a very unusual circumstance. Now, what about the other way around? What happens when you have a woman who's stuck? Is there anything for her to do? What is a woman supposed to do when she is stuck? So we have a concept, we have an idea, which is referred to as Harchakos de Rabbeinu Tam. What are the Harchakos de Rabbeinu Tam? Rabbeinu Tam came up with a great idea, and he said, well, we know the Gemara says you're not allowed to force a husband to divorce his wife. Maybe we can figure out how to put some kind of minimal pressure on him where it's not considered to be actually forcing him. You're not twisting his arm, but you're putting some pressure on him to make him think. So what are you going to do? Says Rabbeinu Tam. Very simple. I'll tell you what to do. What you should do is we should put sanctions on him. How are we going to put sanctions? Well, we're going to tell everyone in the community that no one is allowed to talk to him. We're also going to tell everyone in the community they're not allowed to do business with him, they're not allowed to interact with him at all, they're not allowed to invest his money, they're not allowed to serve him in a restaurant, he's not allowed to buy food in any of the supermarkets, and when he gets sick, nobody's allowed to visit him. And maybe that will force him to start thinking differently. If the entire community distances themselves from him, then maybe that will make him think carefully about the consequence of what he's doing, and then he will come around one day and say he wants to divorce his wife, he wants to give her a gift. Now, what's the obvious question? What's the obvious question? Isn't that considered forcing him? You're not allowed to force someone, so isn't that forcing him? No? So what's the answer? So the Rishonim say, first of all, you're not beating him up. You're not forcing him in that way. And we're not forcing him. We're not saying anything on him. We're telling the community what to do. I have a right to do whatever I want. I'm not forcing him to do anything. I'm deciding I'm not going to talk to him anymore. Nope. If he's so uncomfortable, let him move somewhere else. That's not forcing him. He can move to another community. So it's interesting. The whole rationale for why this is allowed and not considered to be forcing is because he can move to another community. So I'm thinking, today in our generation, when we do our Chakas de Rabbeinu Tam, he can't move to another community. Why? Because if he moves to another community, we'll spread it on the internet, we'll tell everybody there what kind of person he is, and everywhere he goes, this is going to follow him. So how are we allowed to do our Chakas de Rabbeinu Tam? What's the answer? I think it's a great question. Right? Rabbeinu Tam said this is not considered forcing a husband to give a get because he has the option to move somewhere else. If he's so uncomfortable, he can either give the get or move out. So today, he can move out. Why? Because if he moves out somewhere else, they're going to go after him again. And with the internet, they're going to spread it around, and which they should, but then he's forced. Isn't that considered a get mu'usa? I think the answer is, as much as the internet now publicizes everything about everyone, and he won't be able to run away from it, the internet also emboldens crazy people. and he finds a community of people who are just like him. This person moved to a community where I'm told there are a bunch of people like him. How do they find each other? Through the internet. And now because of the internet, they embolden each other and they don't care what anybody says. And we can hang up signs about them, we can say whatever we want. It's interesting that the very problem of the internet for the Arachakas Dei Rabbeinu Tam is the solution as well. Because the internet allows everybody to be in touch with each other, and that's why the information is going to spread, and maybe you consider that to be forcing him to even get. The answer is no. With the internet, he's able to find the community that will accept him, and a community that won't have any problem with Rishayim like him. So that's the answer. So we have the Arachakas Dei Rabbeinu Tam. Now says the Ramah, well, Rabbeinu Tam said we shouldn't talk to him. Rabbeinu Tam said that we shouldn't do business with him. We shouldn't sell him any food. We shouldn't allow him into the supermarket. Don't count him to a minion. All these kinds of things that will make him very uncomfortable. And either option A is he'll give a get. Option B is he will go ahead and he will divorce his and he will move out of the community if he so chooses to do. Now says the Ramah, let me give you a few more examples. Let's say he gives birth to a child. His wife was pregnant, whatever, before they had this mess. And then he gives birth to a child. Says the Ramah, don't give the child a bris. Then the Ramah says, what happens if he dies? Now, if he dies, that's good. Then his wife can get remarried, right? I mean, that's the famous stories about Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that you had women who came in to talk to him about their issues with Aguna, and he called the husband in and he said, listen, your wife's either going to be an Almana or a Grusha. You can decide. What that means is, for those who didn't get it, either you're going to die and your wife is going to be allowed to get remarried that way, or you'll give a get like a mensch and then your wife will be able to get remarried that way. Now, we're not Rabbi Akiva Eiger. We don't threaten like that. But if you were Rabbi Akiva Eiger and it actually worked, then tavo aleichem bracha. But over here, the question is, so what happens? So the Shulchan Aruch writes over here, if he dies. Now that doesn't mean if he dies, because if he dies then there's no problem. It means if his child dies. So if a young child who tragically dies, his father's a ma'agin, writes the Ramah, we're not going to bury the child until his father gives the mother a get. It's an amazing psak. That's an unbelievable psak. Now, what right do we have to make a child suffer for his parent? That's a very good question. But this is what the Ramah writes. And then the question is over here, would we extend that to a parent? The Shulchan Aruch is just saying, the Ramah is just saying a common case where you have a child who's going to die. That means a lot to a parent to be able to bury his child, obviously. He's going to be so shaken up when the Chevra Kadisha says, we're not going to take care of your child, we're not going to bury him. So obviously it's going to compel him to give a get. So the Ramah says that would be an acceptable Arachakas Dei Rabbeinu Tam, which is a chiddush, because that sounds very much like you're forcing him, like you're strong-arming him. But that's what the Ramah says. So why wouldn't we say the same for a parent? So this is actually a very, very interesting issue. Number one, you have to really determine whether or not the parents are supporting their child. If a parent is not supportive of a child who's being ma'agin, his wife, you can't hold the parents responsible. People are adults. People make crazy decisions in their lives. People decide to do all kinds of wild things. You cannot hold the parents responsible when their child is making a decision to do this to his wife. So you first have to determine, even to get into the whole discussion, are the family members really involved in his decision not to divorce his wife? And if so, if they are, and they're really supporting him not to give his wife a get, should they really deserve this kind of punishment, that they should be held up and not be allowed to be buried? So let's say in Israel, they made a law, a husband who's ma'agin and his wife, they'll take away his passport. So this is a major debate in the poskim now in Eretz Yisrael. So you're taking away his passport, and you're saying that's Arachakas Dei Rabbeinu Tam. Really? That means you're not forcing me? You're making it so uncomfortable for me in every community in Israel, wherever I'm going to go, and I can't go to America. I can't go to Chutz La'aretz. I can't get out of the country. You took away my passport. You throw a guy in jail. In Israel, they throw a guy in jail if he's ma'agin and his wife for too long. I assume it's not the first day. I assume it's the whole process. But they're willing to throw a guy in jail. So how far do you take the Arachakas Dei Rabbeinu Tam? And again, the operative word here is, we're not allowed to force the husband to give a get, but at the same time, we're allowed to make it extremely uncomfortable for him. So how uncomfortable are we allowed to make it? And that is what the debate is right now. That's what's being heavily discussed. My father feels, go ahead, you have every right to make it as uncomfortable as we can. And that means even withholding the burial of his parents. In this situation that we're describing here, it is well known by the Rabbanim in California that the family is standing behind him and the family has included him in everything all along with his rishus that's been going on for 20 years. Nobody has taken a stand against him and they are all supportive of his decision. And as a result of that, it feels very much appropriate that perhaps the father should be punished for that. Now that's an amazing scene. What's going to happen? Whenever the father's time comes, and he's going to show up in Eretz Yisrael on a plane, in an Aron, what are they going to do? So that's what's being discussed now. The court in Israel is deciding whether or not this is an appropriate step to take, or this is something that is taking it a little bit too far. Rav Asher Weiss, I spoke to him about it at the time when this came up, first go around, and then at the time, Rav David Lau actually reached out to him in the interim period in the last couple of months because he knew that this was something that they were going to have to make a decision about, and he wrote his feelings, but he said, number one, it's important that you really, really have to decide whether or not the parents are responsible for the decision of their child. If that can be determined, then he said, if there really is no other option, which 20 years later there clearly is no other option, there's nothing else that seems to be working, then this is something that he felt was acceptable. And then he just adds on a paragraph at the end where he writes, Ulamoser lahadgish, I just want to point out, he says, as harishus shel hama'agin es ishto shanim rabos, bo'ot shehu chayim isha acheres. While he goes ahead and lives his life and married somebody else and claims he has a heter me'er abanim, which we know is fake, Milvad ha'avel v'ha'avon shel etzem ha'igun. Aside from the fact that you're torturing a person and you're destroying their life, davar zeh marbe mamzerim b'Yisrael, you're also going to cause for mamzerim to be created in the Jewish community. Pa'amim rabos, eina isha yechol olamad b'nisayim. Do you expect a woman for the last 20 years of her life to be alone? You think she's never going to have any boyfriend? You think she's never going to have anybody that she's going to end up in a relationship with? And then maybe she'll have a child. Do you think that that is something that, aside from the pain you're causing her, let's say you hate her and you want her to suffer because of everything she did to you in the marriage, whatever it is, whatever your cheshbon is, your crooked cheshbon is, aside from all of that, what about the factor of mamzerus that you're creating? What about that problem? V'hi yotzes the tarbas rav v'nisses b'cheidu banea ubenosea mamzerim v'dimas ha'oshkim ein lahem menachem. And now you're going to have these children who come along and say, I'm a mamzer or a mamzerus, now what am I going to do? It's exactly what the Gemara says. When you have a case of a mamzer or a mamzeres, it's mu'uvas she'ena yachalisko, and it's a terrible situation that you cannot fix. There's nothing to do about it. So he writes, this is something, v'ama'agin, and a person who holds up his wife from having a divorce, is rala shamayim v'rala brios rasha ben adam l'chavero v'rasha ben adam l'makom l'fikach yesh lifo b'chol ha'emtzaim. We should try all means that we have, u'b'chol chomer hadin, Lishbar Motos Russia. I know that there's an organization in Israel, I'm not going to say the name of it, but it's an organization in Israel that is heavily considering staging a protest outside of Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef's house. And I think that that is highly inappropriate. That makes absolutely no sense. First of all, it's going to boomerang. It's not going to do anything. He's not going to actually change his mind either way because of a protest. He couldn't care less about their protest, and it's not going to make a difference. But aside from that, this is a real halachic issue. This is not something that's about protesting either way. This is about somebody sitting down with the chief rabbi and explaining to him the severity of the case. Protesting is not going to make a difference. What needs to be done is a real sensitivity training. You need to really explain what the details of the case are, what really is the back and forth, what's the history here, who is the Beis Din that wrote a psak that this should be done in California. It's a very reputable Beis Din. And this is something that we need to actually talk about like a mensch. You need to actually discuss like any other shayla that we would discuss. This would be no different. Anyway, I thought that